Welcome to the FinTech Scaling Show. This podcast is sponsored by the Growth Platform Framework. B2B FinTech startups accelerate customer acquisition and set up business operations to scale systematically. When you're ready to grow, reach out to us at richard@ipractitioners.com. Now, over to the show with Richard Dozy, founder and host. Hey, what's up, everyone? Today on the show, we have Manola Atala, co-founder and CEO of Fairplay out in Mexico. Outside of Fairplay, Manola is also an investor, an advisor, and a board member across multiple businesses in Mexico. Prior to this, he was the group CEO of Groupon out in North LATAM. So, whoa. Hey, Manola, great to have you on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me, Richard. How are you doing?
Yeah, cool. Very good. Thank you. So let's get into it. Let's kick off the show and maybe we can start at the beginning. Let's get into that time machine and paint a picture for our listeners. And let's talk about your early career and maybe focus on telling us how that start of your career has helped you succeed on your entrepreneurial journey. And obviously also, more importantly for this episode, the Fairplay journey.
Well, that's actually a pretty interesting question because I have a different background for what you can imagine. I'm an entrepreneur, but I'm not coming from investment banking or consultancy. I'm not an ex-McKinsey or Bain. I have a really strange background. I first started a company at 21, an advertising company that went not really bad, but we needed to shut down because of a regulation problem. But I became a musician after that. Basically, my entrepreneurship career started really early on in my life at 21, then musician, then corporate guy, and then I started to, you know, in the tech ecosystem in Mexico and the entrepreneurship ecosystem way later after that. So I think that my early career helped me just to visualize that I could launch a company. I was really young when I did it the first time, but I think it helped, and music as well helped to realize that that was not what I wanted to do. So I think that that's my early career helped in that way, I think.
What do you mean by helped you visualize how to launch a company?
Well, back in 2000 or 2001, there was no entrepreneur word in my vocabulary. You either become a businessman or you become an employee. And I was a dreamer back in the day. I didn't know that I could launch a company, and I did with a couple of friends. And that changed my mindset very inside of me. I was not, you know, realizing it really, really good. I didn't visualize that I would be an entrepreneur 20 years after. But I think that helped me to say, hey, you can do this. You know, it's not the end of the world. I launched a company. I shut it down a company. It was bad, but I can do this. So I think my mindset changed there. I don't know if it's going to sound a little bit cocky, but, you know, at that time, really young, I was thinking I can do anything. And after that, I started with music. And it's really important because, you know, I started with music. I had a lot of luck as well. But, you know, I played in really good places. And I said, again, I can do whatever I want. So I think that gave me enough confidence to actually do whatever I want. And that helped a lot.
You mentioned confidence. And I guess I was wondering how that actually plays out. And then you taking on quite a substantial role in helping Groupon launch into LATAM and spearheading that launch and that success.
That's really interesting because confidence didn't play there. Actually, it was naive because I didn't know at that time. Well, let me give you a little bit of context here. There were three guys in Chile, two Chilean guys and one Swedish guy, that launched a Groupon clone back in 2010, at the beginning of 2010. And then actually, I think that was the fastest exit in Latin America because, you know, they launched the company and then Groupon bought them really, really fast. And then I met with them, Chiria, and they invited me to launch Mexico with one of them that was living in Mexico at that time. And it was really fun because when they invited me to be part of the management of Latin America, I was naive enough not knowing what the gig is all about, you know? Really hard work, like 7 to 1 a.m. every day, hiring really fast, firing really fast, micromanaging, selling like hell. So that was not confidence, that was naive. So, but it was an amazing experience. Actually, that helped me a lot. I think something break in my head in group one back in 2010 when I said, this is a fast growing business and I need to behave like that as well. And I need to be like super fast and super, you know, if I don't know something, I need to, you know, to learn really fast because I don't want to get behind my peers. At that time, I had really good peers in Argentina, really good peers in Chile, in Colombia, in Brazil as well. And I would not like to be behind them. So it was like pride, naiveness. So it was fun. It was fun, but a lot of learning. It was like two MBAs in 3 years.
Oh, wow. So, you know, maybe like, you know, MBA or an apprenticeship, but it sounds like you obviously learned a lot. You grew a lot. And tell me how this experience has helped you move on and obviously also help in what you're doing at Fairplay.
Well, I think a lot. I think Groupon really helped me to have this background, like pre-training of being an entrepreneur, because I was an intrapreneur at that time. You know, I had a budget, I have money in the bank, and I needed to take a lot of decisions by myself. Of course, sometimes you need to go back and forth with the management to take bigger decisions, but I needed to hire like 140 people in 6 months. And that helped me a lot to know about hiring, because for me, that's one of the key things in order for you to become a really good entrepreneur or for your company to be successful. Hiring, it's really important, extremely important for me. I think a CEO has two jobs, basically. It's making sure that money is in the bank all the time to make sure that the company it's going to have runway. And the second one is to hire the best talent possible in the market. That's for me, my two jobs. I have a lot of things to do. Of course, I do sales, I do marketing, I do a lot of things. But the main two, it's hiring and fundraising. So Groupon helped me to know, well, I did a lot of mistakes back in about 10 years ago or 11 years ago. I did a lot of mistakes hiring. So really good decisions hiring as well that I didn't know at the time, but now I know. And now I analyzed why I hired those people. And I always ask myself, 10 years after, would you be willing to hire that person again? So that's for me the best question in order for you to analyze if you are doing a really good job or not. So I learned a lot from hiring, and I learned a lot of resilience as well. Being an entrepreneur or an intrapreneur, you work with a lot of frustration every day. You need to go as fast as you can or faster than you can sometimes. And you get real frustration every day. So I learned a lot of this kind of stuff there. And of course, more about corporate finance, the boring stuff. But I think the two main things, it's like dealing with myself, with frustration, with my own psychology, and hiring really good people. That for me is key for success.
Just picking up on the hiring part of this, I mean, I was wondering, outside of those learnings, what you have taken forward with you and put in place as you've walked through your business and entrepreneurial career that makes certain that that hiring process or that hiring ritual is one that swoops up the best talent to help push your businesses forward.
I changed a lot my style in hiring my staff and the way I think about hiring in the last 10 years, of course. I thought at the time that hire fast, fire faster, it was the way to go. Now, I think in the first one, I think the opposite. I guess like hire slow and fire fast. That's for me the way to go. Because you need to have a really good process of hiring. You just don't go there and, you know, like somebody and don't do your homework and just hire the person, you know? You need to see if there's even a cultural fit, not just technical skills in IT or sales or marketing. You know, you need to know if that person is going to have a fit with your values, with your culture, if they're going to be getting along with the team. So that's important for me as well. So now we have a really good process, I guess. We first have a first interview with a person to know them, to know their profile, to see behind their eyes a little bit. And then we have a second interview, but with more people to analyze a little bit more of a technical skills. Then we have a cultural interview. And then we have, like, you know, sometimes I have a fourth one with like a 20-minute call in order to make sure that we are aligned with the same thing. You know, I'm really straightforward for hiring as well. I try to manage expectations of people in a good way, in a good manner, because it's really important, because I don't like to sell something that is not true. And then people, you know, are really excited to get into the company. And then they realize that it was all bullshit. And I was lying, because you start really, really bad. Your starting point is really bad there. If you start lying about the company and everything is pretty. And so I set up the expectations really good, probably before hiring. And then the training process and the onboarding process, it's as important as recruitment. You know, because people feel abandoned if you don't do a really good onboarding, even if you are in a high speed and growth environment. You need to take the time and onboard people in a good manner. So that's how we make the process here in Fairplay. And back in the day, you know, a group, well, not a group, and a group, and it was really fast and bad. But a corner shop, a Pulpomatic, and now Fairplay was like, in a better terms, I'd say.
Cool. And going from Groupon, there's a sort of a 10-year, nine or 10-year, I guess, pathway to leading up to Fairplay. What type of things were you involved in? I know you've got a varied career, which a varied entrepreneurial journey, which has led you down to and finally led you towards Fairplay. So it would just be, you know, a quick insight as to the things that you've got up with would be, I think our listeners would like to get that detail.
Yeah, so I can give you a roadmap of my last 10 years.
Yeah.
Or a line of my last 10 years. It was really fun as well. But I stayed at Groupon for 3 years. I was there when Groupon IPO'd back in 2011, I think. So I learned a lot there. Because, you know, you needed to report a lot of things to the finance team in Latin America. And then they were reporting to the US in order for, you know, to make the IPO and stuff like that. So I learned a lot. In that process, I was not involved, of course, in the IPO process because I was just a managing director of Mexico and Puerto Rico. But I learned a lot of things happening behind me in operations, finance, marketing, PR, a lot of PR around that. So I learned a lot there in Groupon. So I left Groupon in 2013. I burned out. There were like 3 really amazing years, but really hard physically. Physically and you know, my psychology was like really bad year number 3. And then I decided to step down. A lot of people from the management actually stepped down that time in the same year, basically, because they were like burned out as well. We did our best, but we were like really tired. So after that, I launched a consultancy business to give service to companies in Europe that wanted to soft land in Latin America, most of them e-commerce companies. So I started doing consultancy. I learned a lot of things as well, but it was really boring because I was working alone with a European timing. So I just worked at really, really soon in the morning. And then after 1 p.m. in Mexico, I was doing nothing. So it was really good in learning, but really boring because I'm a team person. I like to work with people. And then after that, it was really funny because I was board of advisors member of Sindelantal. Sindelantal was a food delivery company. I think the first one in Spain, and actually the first one in Mexico. Well, they were the biggest ones in Mexico. So they sold the company in Spain, and then they invited me to be board of advisors of the Mexican company. And then after a couple of years, they sold the company to Just Eat in the UK. And just the same week they sold the company, I received an invitation from Oscar Jertelsen, now co-founder and CEO of Corner Shop, to go to San Francisco to, you know, to explain me a business plan they had at that time, now Corner Shop. So they invited me to invest. at the beginning. So I said, yes, those three guys are for me one the best entrepreneurs I've ever met in my life. So I would be investing in them even if they sell like dust in the desert. So they invited me to do that. And then they asked me to launch Mexico because they were living in San Francisco at the time and I was here in Mexico. So I launched the first team and the company here for the first year. But I had already plans to launch a SaaS company with Tim Delantal, one of the founders. And I did that. I launched Corner Shop for the first year. Then they came to live in Mexico City. So I left the business. I was an investor. At the beginning, a launcher and then just an investor and advisor. And then I launched the SaaS business, which is another, you know, another animal, completely different from consumer products, different from finance, from fintech. It's totally different. The sales process, it's amazing, but it's really hard to get there to do product market fit. It's really hard as well. So as you can see, I've been learning from different kinds of companies and focusing on different markets are super interesting as well for my own nurturing of my profile or my executive profile, if you want to say it like that. Professional profile, not executive. And then after that, after Pulpomatic, I decided to step down of the company after 2.5 years or 2.5 years because I was not happy there. Something happened in my head. I was not happy at all. Not because of my co-founders, not because of the product. The product was amazing. It's amazing. They're doing really good right now. But something happened in my head. I was, you know, low energized. Every time I woke up at that time, I was really sad. I was uncomfortable with myself. So I needed to step down. I didn't know at that time if it was like the company, it was just me, it was my environment. I don't know. I still don't know. But I decided to step down because I was, you know, delaying the company. I was putting bad energy to a company and it was my company. So it was really bad for them and for the people. So I stepped down there and I received an amazing invitation that changed my life again. Like Groupon 10 years for Hector Sepulveda from Mountain Nazca, for me, the best venture capital firm in Mexico. He invited me to be part of the operations of the fund because I had some experience launching companies, most of it. And a lot of the companies, you know, they invested in, they are really early on. So they need a lot of help to launch. So I became the COO of the fund. And one of my tasks there was to look out for really good business models that nobody were doing in Latin America. We look for Africa, we look for Asia, for Europe, for US, to see really good business models that can make a really good fit for the region, but nobody were doing. And that's how we got to the business model of Fairplay. That was the breaking point there to realize that the main thing I wanted to do for my next 10, 15 or whatever years in the future. So it was really good to find out that that business model was like really empty in the Latin American space. So I decided to step down from the fund and do it myself with the help of the fund as an investor. We talk, actually, it was a really funny story as well, because one of the LPs of the fund, it's a really good friend of mine since we were really young. And the first time I thought about a co-founder for this company, not thinking about me, thinking about somebody to launch the company, it was him because of his profile. My co-founder, Andrew James Devlin, he has an amazing profile. Like he's a mix between finance and product and technology, of course. And it was a perfect fit for this business model. So we talked the fund, Andrew and myself, and we decided to launch the company with the help of the fund. And then after that, of course, with the QED investors that invested or lead invested our first round. So that was my last 10 years in a nutshell. So as you can see, I have been doing a lot of things, really exciting things. And most of it, I had a lot of fun in the last 10 years.
It sounds like an amazing journey. I mean, but let's look at Fairplay for a second. And just for our listeners, can you describe what problem Fairplay is solving for the Latin American market?
So basically, and that's a really good question. Actually, I'm going back to January 2018, when one of my tasks was to look out for really good business models. Yeah. The first thing that pops in my mind that blew my mind up, it was a paper that, I don't know, I don't remember if it was Sequoia or Andreessen Horowitz. They sent a paper or I downloaded a paper they wrote, and saying that they basically receive 3,000 companies a year in their, you know, in their web page or either with introductions or whatever other means, they receive 3,000 companies in their fund. From those 3,000 companies, they just actually, you know, see more deeply or analyze, actually, even analyze like 200. Because the other 2,800, like they receive, they are not just not a fit with the fund or with the investment thesis of the fund. You know, a lot of e-commerce companies, lifestyle businesses, whatever, you know, a drugstore probably, I don't know. And then from those 200 companies, they invested in between 30 and 40. So that's a really sad number, because if there are like thousands of companies out there trying to raise capital or to you know, to have fuel for growth, and you invested in just 30 or 40, this means that just 1 or 1.5% of the companies receive money from either venture capital firms, like venture debt funds. Even those companies don't receive a credit line from the bank. And we saw a really good opportunity here, because in Latin America, the new digital economy businesses that are growing, it's like thousands and thousands of company, new companies in Latin America popping up every year. And those companies, of course, can't receive a credit line from a bank because they need to have like at least 3 years of existence. They need to have EBITDA. They need to have a really healthy P&L. And these companies, the new digital economy companies, are growing. They're losing a little bit of money every year, the first 2 years. And then they can be backed by banks. They can be backed by VCs. They can be backed by venture debt. So they just have friends and family to go. So it's really insane that nobody's focusing in this vertical, in this sector. And we saw the opportunity here. Because if you see really closely, Europe has a really specific set of problems that they are solving, right? The US, for example, as you can see, there's not as fintechs in the US as in Latin America, because you know the access to capital in Latin America is a bigger problem than in the US. It's a bigger problem than Europe and Asia, probably. So you have Africa, you have Middle East, some of the countries of Middle East, emerging markets, most of it, and Latin America with this humongous amount of, you know, fintech companies. So if you match the tiny amount of resources that these kind of companies, this sector receive, and the big problem Latin America has, it becomes an amazing opportunity to address. So that's why we came up with this and to solve this problem. Access to capital for the new digital economy companies in the region. And in our case, we are focusing in e-commerce companies by now, just for now. We're going to, of course, launch other verticals in the future, but now we are focusing in e-commerce. And we invest in those companies in the three major investments they need more money in, which are inventory, or marketing online, like customer acquisition, and logistics costs. That's the main part of your unit economics as an e-commerce.
And because it was an opportunity, and you guys sound like you are the first to the market, or if not the first, one of the first arrivals, how did you go around making, through that product market fit process, how did you figure that out and make certain that, yeah, this is the right opportunity? We do have the right product or offering, and yeah, let's start moving this forward.
It's really good that you asked this question, because actually I've heard a couple of episodes of your show talking about product market fit, and it's really interesting and really hard, let's say. Because you could be super biased in the process to go to product market fit. You could be really biased, because one of the main needs to know if you are getting to product market fit, it's that people buy your product. If you have people paying for your product, if you have a certain amount of clients paying consistently for your product, and you receive really good comments from your clients, and then they recommend you to other clients, you can say that you have product market fit, but you can be really wrong there. You know, you could be really biased. For a B2B company, it's harder to notice if you are getting closer to product market fit than if you have a consumer product or a B2C business, right? The B2C business, you have lower tickets and you have more volume of people. So you can measure a lot of things. when you're a B2B company, you start to work your first year, your first 6 months with a tiny amount of companies. And when is really good to start seeing product market fit with the amount of ticket you have? Because we are trying to invest between $10,000 to $2 million in companies. So we have an average there of, you know, $100,000. So we have 40 clients. We have 45 clients. How you measure that you are getting closer to product market fit with 40 clients at the beginning? If you are allocating like $5 million, $6 million in your first 12 months, it sounds really big. It sounds like $6 million in loans are big for the first year, right? Or at least for Mexico. 40 clients for some businesses are really good. For some other businesses are really bad. You know, I'm used to work with thousands of, you know, customers as a B2C focused company. But right now with 45, it's like, it's insane when I'm getting closer to product market fit. So answering your question, it's really hard to get to product market fit. And basically you never stay or never get to product market fit and you stay there. Going to product market fit, it's an ongoing process for the rest of your life, because you can do really bad things with your product, with your added value, with a lot of things. And then you can, you know, reverse product market, even if you are doing really good. So I think that we are in the process to get closer and closer every time. I think we need to get at least between 100 and 200 businesses in order to measure more detail about our product. We are iterating our product a lot in the last 3 to 6 months, because what we are trying to do, and for all your followers and listeners, product market fit, it's not getting just the best product. You need to iterate a lot of your product for a long time. And there are a lot of companies that are doing this mistake, and it's really, really dangerous. Most of it, the founders that are really product focused, IT focused, they tend to have the perfect products in terms of usability that makes sense in their head. But sometimes these kind of companies don't ask the market or their clients what's wrong with the product or what's good with the product, or they don't do the research they need to do. Basically, you are squeezing your client's brain for the first 6 to 8, 12 months in order to know if your product is solving a problem. Because you can think that your product is solving a problem, but they're probably, you're not solving their problem, their specific problem. Probably you have a bias and you think that your product needs to be this way, and the market is expecting something different, or, you know, needs something different. So you can leave between a bias of your own. There's a Spanish say, like a mechanic blindness bias or whatever. I don't know how to translate this to English, but you can be really blind to your product if you don't do your research outside in the street with your clients.
Yeah.
So it's really important.
Yeah, that's a great tip. And as you guys have grown up and you've got customers of 45 clients on board now, if we look at, you know, the operational aspects of your business, what structures or maybe rituals, let's call it rituals, what rituals are you putting in place to support the continued growth of your operations?
That's another really good question. Actually, you say the magic word. The rituals here are important. We have a lot of rituals, and those rituals became processes. That's really funny that you mentioned that, because it's really important for the culture of the company and for the mentality or mindset of the company to have those rituals. We have a lot. Since we started the pandemic back in March last year, we started, of course, to, you know, to do remote work every other person in the company. At that time, we were six, so it was really easy. Every day, we jump in a daily call, the six of us, two founders, four heads, or four founding team members. And it was really easy. It was really easy because we needed to do less stuff at the beginning. So we split work and we said, okay, you need to do this, I'm going to do that. Who's needing my help today? Because I have to do this or that, I need to do this presentation or whatever. I have these calls with customers and whatever. So it was really easy at the beginning, and it was kind of a mess, a really organized mess. We were shooting whatever other, you know, prospect we could find out there. So at the beginning, for example, we had this ritual that then 1 year later became a process that it was like, okay, the head of customer success and myself were like invested like a couple of hours on Instagram every day, having screenshots of the ones that were advertising banners, because those were our clients. Oh, those are our clients, because we were investing at that time just in marketing online, in online marketing, sorry. So it was like our main lead generation source at the beginning. And it was fine when we were two or six or four. But right now it's a mess if you still do that. So that became a ritual. So every night we spend a couple of hours on Instagram. We send a lot of screenshots from advertising. So then that became a team. So we hired a couple of lead generation people. So they received those and they put it in our CRM. And then that process or ritual became a bigger process where we nurtured those leads in the CRM. And we decided, you know, who to call in cold calling, who to send an email, who to, you know, who to send a direct message on TikTok or Instagram or whatever. And then now we have a really good process where we have a company that nurtured the leads, sorry, a team that nurtured the leads. And then we have a lead generation team, then the SDRs, and then, you know, marketing do a lot of communication with those leads, and then sales touch base with those leads, with the ones that answered something and stuff like that. So I think that a really tiny ritual that you be consistent with, you need to be consistent with your rituals in order to have really good processes after.
I've got to ask you, because you touched on some great points there, but how do you view these rituals or processes? Do you view them as sort of inputs and outputs, or do you view them as something that needs to be put in place that will allow you guys as a team to achieve an objective?
I think there are two things that you're mentioning there. One of them is how to maintain focus in those rituals and how those became a process. And then how to get to the goals, how to achieve your milestones or objectives or whatever. So I think those are linked. I think consistency, it's one of the things that links the rituals and the processes and the objectives. For example, we have an OKRs meeting every year. Well, last year it was like half year, because our first 6 months we were learning a lot of things. And then we set up the OKRs for the rest of the semester in June. But for this year, we reunited all the company all together, all hands meeting in January last month. And we expressed every other aspect of the OKRs that we needed to implement for this year, right? So that's a ritual as well. It's part ritual, part putting the objectives and setting the goals.
Yeah.
But one of those rituals is in the OKRs, for example, is something I do and I really enjoy doing this. I put names to everything. I'm not a bellic person. I'm not a war person, but I really love history. And every time I put like OKRs, I tell a story before. So this year, it was the story of Constantinople, the Byzantine Empire, and how the Turkish invaded the Byzantine Empire and they won the Golden Horn and stuff like that. So basically, I put a story behind our OKRs, and that's becoming a ritual now. And I want people to understand how I'm seeing things and how I see the vision, telling stories. I love to say stories with my teams and stuff like that. And then after the OKRs, we do a rehearsal. We call the rehearsal because for us, December 31st is our show. I'm a musician. My co-founder loves music as well. Everything in Fairplay has music names. We have our, for example, our backend names Mozart, you know, our data lake or our, you know, our data team. They have a lot of names for music. So every month we have a rehearsal. So in that rehearsal, it's the first Thursday of every month. And we have an all hands where we say how we are evolving with our, you know, goals. And every team send us before their achievements of that prior month. And it's becoming a really good ritual because we have a DJ that puts music the first 10 minutes and we kind of know that person because of their music preferences. And then we have housekeeping things in order to say like operational stuff. And then we get deep in the milestones and how everyone is achieving or not their key results. like for an hour or an hour and a half. And then we close the session with some problem that someone came up with. And then we put all the brains in the company trying to solve that problem. You know, it could be a sales problem that the IT team is helping to solve, probably with technology, the operational team helping with their mindset, the finance team as well. So it's a really good ritual that helps people to empathize with others' problems. Sometimes the finance team or the IT team, they don't know how the sales team struggle with rejection, probably with lack of leads or nurture leads, or they don't know how the sales team receive a lot of no's every day or every week and how frustrating that could be. And that makes a lot of, to become empathic with your teammates. And that's why we put that ritual at the end, you know, to solve a problem from every other team in the company and every all hands, all the brains trying to solve that. So it's really interesting how your rituals became processes and they became goals. So everything is linked up. I don't know if I explained myself.
But you did. I think I'm going to go away and I now want to become a DJ and come to your rehearsal and listen to Mozart and the symphony go on, because it sounds like a pretty cool ritual and process that you guys have pulled together. A cool band, right?
It's really fun.
Cool, man. I mean, listen, so as you guys are moving forward and scaling up, what are the questions that you're asking yourselves, and what are maybe the outside factors or the inside factors even that you're considering to make certain you continue on that growth trajectory?
That's really fun you ask, because we do a lot of questions. We question ourselves a lot. I think it's necessary, not just in business, in life, you need to question everything. But in my case, in my perspective as CEO and salesperson, because I'm another salesperson of the company, you know, I'm selling every time. This is something I learned from the Sandberg brothers that you probably know from Rocket Internet. They would say you need to be ABC every day, you know, always be closing. So that's really deep in my mindset. So one of the things that I question every day to myself is this product the best product we can have for the market? Is this the best product for this set of customers that we are already approaching right now? Is our team the best team available in order to meet the next milestone or the next growth stage of the company? Am I the best CEO to go to probably a 500 million company, a billion company dollar valuation? You know, so I question myself every other day. It feels really bad, but you really need to ask yourself these kind of things. They are really hard, but you need at the same time, and I'm not going to make a contradiction here, but you need to ask that and then execute. You can't stay questioning things every day, all day. You need to question and then you need to execute at the same time. So one of the things that we are questioning against is, are we going as fast as we can? For example, we see our competitors in Europe, right? We see, for example, Wayflyer, that you probably know.
Yeah.
So those folks are doing an amazing job. They have, well, they started like a year and a half before Fairplay. So they have a leverage there. And they have another leverage, which is like Europe, it's way much advanced in terms of e-commerce and technology. And the reception of technology and product and finance products for this sector. So they have more leverage, of course. But these guys are doing really, really fast. They are doing an amazing job in sales and in technology. They have a really, really cool product. If you ask me, who's your go-to in terms of trying to imitate their work, it's Wayflyer. Even more than ClearBank, which is the biggest in the world, you know? Because they are really good in product, they are really good in sales, they are doing really good. So we question, okay, are we doing a really fast job here? We are growing as fast as we can. Those guys are doing a really good job. Are we doing a really good job? So it's not that we are comparing with them every day, but you need to put a standard, you know? You need to put a ceiling to meet, and you need to take out that ceiling and then put another one higher. So our questions are all around the team and all around the product. But for me right now, it's the two most important questions. For example, right now in a fundraising process, I'm raising debt and I'm raising equity, right? So I'm not questioning that. of course, you have doubts. You talk to a lot of investors and they make you doubt of your own business model because they ask you a lot of things. But I never question that because I know that our business model is really good and our arguments to raise that amount are perfectly aligned. But the team and the product, it's always what is keeping me questioning things every day. So that's what we question and that's what we are trying to iterate the most, hire better people every time and build an amazing product that the market needs. I don't know if that's the question you asked.
Yeah, listen, I think great response, right? I mean, just keep on questioning and don't sit on the question, don't ponder, execute. I mean, it's pretty powerful stuff right there.
Oh, good.
And listen, I mean, as all entrepreneurs and people that like learning, you know, generally we are either reading a book or listening to something on YouTube or the like. And, you know, I'd like to ask you that. I mean, is there anything right now or in the past that, you know, any book that you've read that you think our listeners would be wise to pick it up and read through for themselves?
Sure thing. Actually, there are a couple of books that are most, if you're in the entrepreneurship path. One of those, it's The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. Mm-hmm. It's an insanely really good book. It has a lot of insight. It's a really good storytelling person, Ben Horowitz. And of course, his experience, it's among us. So that's an amazing book to read. It's a must. I think that if you are trying to, or if you have the personality that cares about the culture of your company, for sure, and it's not that I'm doing advertising to Ben Horowitz here, but he writes really good books. It's What You Do Is Who You Are. It's about how you create, you know, your culture inside your business. Your own culture. So he writes a few stories about culture, you know, Japanese samurais. They write a people in jail, a person in jail that gives you really good advice. So I think those two books from Ben Horowitz are amazing for entrepreneurship. And there's a few others that are not for entrepreneurship, but are really interesting. There's one book named You Are Not So Smart from David McRae. That is really good because it says, like, basically, we are all biased. We are all biased. We think we know stuff, but we are, you know, really dumb in a lot of things. That's a really interesting book that changed a little bit of your mindset. And right now, I'm trying to start The Psychedelics Explorer's Guide from James Fadiman. It's a 60s book, actually, that, you know, it's from a really highly respected psychologist, a researcher back in the 60s that, you know, are doing a lot of studies back in the day, did a lot of studies back in the day of microdosing of LSD at that time to find out the human potential in psychology and the brain power and stuff like that. It's really interesting. I've been willing to start the book like since last week, but I have a lot of work. So that's my main go-to book right now. I want to start that and that's it. I think those are really interesting books. Two of entrepreneurship, one of really interesting, you know, stuff about bias and this topic of psychedelics, which is really interesting for me.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I've noted them down for myself. I think I'm going to read all three of them. So, yeah, awesome. Sounds good, man. And as we wrap up the show for today, how can our listeners reach out to you and the team at Fairplay?
We have our ways. They can reach me out in LinkedIn. I'm like Manolo Atala, like altogether in every other, you know, Twitter, in LinkedIn, on Instagram as well, on Facebook. To Fairplay, we have an email, info@getfairplay.com, or my personal email, which is manolo@getfairplay.com.
Amazing. And listen, Manolo, it's been an amazing ride today. I've really enjoyed our conversation today. And, you know, I think it will be great to get you back on the show at some point just to see where you are in that journey. I know you guys are, you know, just sort of a year and a half, 2 years into it. So definitely love to get you back in the next few months to see what's going on.
Sure thing, Richard. And thank you very, very much for inviting me to your show. It's amazing. I'm a fan as well. I enjoy the conversation. We were actually 13 months old. We're not even in the 1 year and a half old. But sure, let's talk down the road. I wish I can give you really good news. in the next 6 to 12 months. And thanks again for inviting me. It was an amazing hour. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, let's stay in touch and looking forward to getting this live with you.
Great, man. Thank you very much.